Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Purim. This week is Purim. This is the special podcast for Purim. There'll be another podcast later this week for Tzav. This podcast is by Rabbi Meir Schweiger. Rabbi Schweiger is a member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Today I would like to speak about what I call the Purim world, the reality of King Ahasuerus, as described in Megillat Esther, and eventually compare it to the society which the Torah is trying to create, the ideal reality of the Jewish people. Let us begin by noting there seems to be a very real lack of historical context in the world of Ahasuerus. The Megillah begins, and it was in the days of King Ahasuerus, without really telling me who is this king, what is his pedigree, what has he accomplished in his life. We also don't have any sense of ultimately where is this society headed. The only historical reference which we have is mentioned in chapter 2, when we talk about Mordechai. We talk about his lineage. We talk about Mordechai as being the one who was exiled prior to the destruction of the first temple by King Nebuchadnezzar. We speak about Mordechai HaYehudi, which tells me where he comes from, the tribe of Judah. But the Purim world of King Ahasuerus is a world which is very much preoccupied with the here and now, which is not particularly interested in the past nor in the future. This becomes very apparent when immediately in the beginning of the Megillah, the king makes a party for all of his officers, a party which lasts 180 days. And when we talk about party, we essentially are talking about in Hebrew mishteh, related to the word lishtot, which means drinking. Drinking is a very central element of this society. On the one hand, you could say, as we find in Psalms, V'yayin yisamach levav enosh. Drinking is what makes people happy. Without going into a whole psychological analysis, if you need to have a 180-day party of non-stop drinking, you are either very, very happy, or you have a very, very real need to somehow find happiness, and the only place to find it is in your drinking. What else do we find in this society? In the context of the party, of the drinking, the goal is to be able to show off the splendor of the kingdom. There is mention made of all the different lavish materials that characterize the palace. One could say there's a tremendous amount of emphasis on externals. The glory of the king is very much connected with the objects that he presents that are impressive. Today we call it a lot of razzle-dazzle. What's very interesting, though, is that that preoccupation with appearance, with externals, is then also extended to people. And as we're told in the first chapter, when the king's heart is good, after having drunk some wine, he summons the queen Vashti, and this is chapter 1, verse 11, to come before the king in her crown of royalty to show off to the nations and to the princes her beauty, because she was in fact beautiful. In the same way that the king wants to show off his palace, his materials, he wants to show off his queen. His queen is no more than an object, a possession of the king. And that point becomes reinforced in chapter 2. After the queen is removed, all the young women are gathered together to find a replacement. And then we're told of the whole procedure, the whole preparation before they come before the king. This is chapter 2. We're told about how they're given all kinds of anointing oils. Elaborate detail, 6 months where they anoint themselves with myrrh oil, 6 months where they have all kinds of other spices and fragrances so that they make a proper appearance before the king. This fascination with how I look, how I appear, seems to be a central feature of the Megillah. Appearances become very, very important on another level. throughout the Megillah, there is the appearance of law and how law plays a central element. There's even the idea that once a law has been signed, has been passed by the king, it cannot be revoked. Law is very, very important. Law is what, in a certain sense, reflects the values of our society. Law is what gives stability to the society, gives it structure. And yet when we look at the procedure, how do you go about making laws? It seems to be that it's actually done in a very impulsive way. When the queen does not come and adhere to the bidding of the king, so right away the king calls all of his advisors. All of a sudden there is a major problem that needs to be addressed. This is no longer a local issue. This becomes a major national issue, which requires that a law be passed. And ultimately you create a law which is not only relevant to the queen, but relevant to all the women in the kingdom. That every woman must listen to whatever her husband says. That every man must rule in his house. Obviously, reading this from a 21st century perspective, this is comic. This is so absurd, so ridiculous. But this is not the only law which we come across. Later on, Mordechai does not want to bow down to Haman. No longer is it a question of some issue between Mordechai and Haman. Immediately this becomes, again, generalized to the general Jewish population. It's not only that Mordechai committed some type of crime, but all of a sudden the Jews now are held accountable. And all of a sudden the Jews now have to be punished for what Mordechai did. The Jews have to be exterminated. And a law is passed that on such and such a day, the people should rise up and kill off all the Jews. But it doesn't stop there. When eventually Esther comes and pleads the case of the Jews and reveals her identity and requests that the law be rescinded, but we can't do that. Once a law has been issued, it can't be taken back. So then we create another law, which is let the Jewish people defend themselves and kill all those who threaten them. So if we step back for a moment and look at what ostensibly is a society which is predicated on law, what do these laws create? They create a reality which is chaotic. They create a reality which is destructive. They create a reality which strips people of their human dignity, all in the name of the law, all in the name of laws which are immutable, which take on a power of their own, where somehow the law is greater than the one who created it, and where the one who created it has no control over it. Which perhaps brings us to two other elements that we find in the society. I mentioned a moment ago that the result of the law is to create chaos, to create confrontation, destruction. A word which comes up later on in the Megillah, and which we have a song for, V'nahafochu, it was overturned. And later on at the very end in chapter 9, we speak about how the days of Purim were overturned. Days which ostensibly should have been days of mourning have now become days of rejoicing. But this phrase, nahafochu, seems to characterize Persian society. Everything is topsy-turvy. Everything is always going up and down. Today, Haman is a second in command to Ahasuerus. He has the power. All of a sudden, within no time, everything is turned on its head. Haman, who was so all-powerful, is then hung. Mordechai, who brought about what was almost a calamity upon the Jewish people, becomes the savior of the Jewish people, becomes the one who then takes over and becomes the second in command to Ahasuerus. Vashti, who in the beginning of the story is described as the jewel in the crown, who is the glory of Ahasuerus, who he wants to show off to everybody. The queen, who makes her own independent party, comparable to the king, who ostensibly seems to be the person who is his equal. All of a sudden, she doesn't fulfill the desires of the king. She disappears. Which means we're talking about a society where there is no sense of security. There is no sense of stability. Where even when you think you've made it, things could completely change on a whim. The idea of a whim is at the core of the name of this holiday, which perhaps describes the society. Purim. What is Purim? Purim is a lot. Chance. Fate. How do we decide when Haman wants to kill the Jews? How does he pick a date? Cast lots. But maybe everything in the society is determined on lots, on whims, on all of a sudden just having a feeling. Today, I love the Jews. Yesterday, I hated the Jews. Today, I love Vashti. Tomorrow, I will have her head. It's all a question of how I feel. There is no thought which is given. There is no long-term picture. Everything is, how do I solve a situation at the moment without thinking about what will be the long-term implications of it? Let's throw in another element. Masks. People wear masks. Queen Esther, or before she is Queen Esther, Esther, when she is rounded up, is told by Mordechai, do not disclose what people you belong to. She wears a mask. She hides her true identity. It's only when the moment becomes opportune that the mask falls. God is not mentioned at all in the Megillah. It's as if God is wearing a mask. And the rabbis, in a variety of ways, look at different elements that are happening and somehow try to see how God is removing the mask, although that is never explicitly stated in the Megillah. We never find God actually mentioned. The Purim world is a world of masks, where people do not necessarily say what they really think, where people do not really communicate. The king hides behind a mask, King Ahasuerus. The king uses the law to create a further facade for him. Maybe I should phrase this a little bit differently. People do not really communicate. People do not really have relationships. People manipulate. The king, who is described in the beginning as being all-powerful, when we read what he does, is really a wimp. And in fact, it seems to be that he uses his advisors to somehow hide behind. They're the ones who really set the policy. Queen Esther, in the end, she is the one who gets what she wants to do. Who is really pulling the strings over here? And when there's something which becomes a problem, the king can always get his advisors to somehow extricate him from that. Or he could hide behind the law and say, but the law has a power of its own which I can't change. So that in the end, we're living in a world which is what we would call today a virtual reality, where people cannot really say what they think, where people cannot really be who they are, where everything is operating behind a mask. Perhaps I would like to also bring up one other mask. On Purim, we celebrate the deliverance of the Jewish people. The deliverance of the Jewish people comes about through Queen Esther, through Mordechai. And in a true Hollywood fashion, it would seem they all live happily ever after. But is that really so? Let's think about this for a moment. On the one hand, yes, the Jews were under threat of extermination. The Jews achieved a victory over their enemies. Haman and his sons are killed. Esther is the queen. Mordechai is the second in command. The Jews now have the power. But at the end of the Megillah, we could perhaps ask ourselves the question, for how long? Is this something which will last forever? It would seem very likely that at some point maybe a new Haman will come on the scene. And maybe at one point Ahasuerus will once again have a party and once again get drunk and once again maybe make a request which is unacceptable to his queen and unacceptable to his second in command. And then once again we will have a revolution and once again we will have a nafochu. It is interesting that when Mordechai urges Esther to actually go to the king, he says, or he intimates, perhaps this is the reason why you became the queen, so that you should bring about the redemption of the Jewish people. But in fact, what seems to be is that the redemption of the Jewish people does not actually come about, and to even use Mordechai's own language, what seems to be is that there will be what he calls revach v'hatzalah. There'll be a breathing space. There will be a saving, but not necessarily a redemption. And I would like to conclude by saying the following. Many, many years ago, I was very fortunate to have as a colleague in Pardes, Rachel Kitzis, who was the daughter of Rabbi Eliyahu Kitov, wrote a book which maybe many people may be familiar with called The Book of Our Heritage. And I'll never forget that one time she quoted her father as making the following comment. When he spoke about galut, exile, and geula, redemption, he said that galut is basically the gap between the real and the ideal. The greater the gap, the greater we live in a reality of exile. Geula, redemption, is the merging, or at least, at the very least, the coming close together of the real and the ideal. The Purim world, in many ways, is the ultimate expression of galut. The Purim world is the total inversion of everything which the Torah stands for, which I would call the ideal. The vision that the Jewish people have of what we are to be, what it means to be a Mamlechet Kohanim and a Goy Kadosh, a nation of priests and a holy people. The Jewish people are not preoccupied with the here and now. We have a sense of a past, we have a sense of a future. There is a sense of who we began as, but a very definite image of what we would like to become. And at every moment, what are we doing to work towards that end, as opposed to just living in the moment, being oblivious of where we came from and where we're going to? The Torah is a book of law that creates structure, stability, that is not based on whim, caprice, randomness, but is based on ethics, is based on human dignity, is trying to create a stability so that I know if this is what I follow, this is what will in the end be. If I don't follow it, these are the penalties. Everything is laid out. Yes, drinking wine is something which can gladden the heart. It can actually become a ritual procedure. It can be invested with holiness. But priests who serve in the temple, rabbis who are part of rabbinical courts, are not allowed to drink. Because when you are in service of God, when you are creating laws, it has to be done in full consciousness. It has to be directed and focused with all of your thoughts. It can't be based on a whim. In Judaism, we are encouraged not to wear masks, not to hide behind facades. We're encouraged to communicate directly. We're encouraged to always keep things in proportion. We don't behind things. We want things to be up front. In this past week's Parsha, Parshat Pekudei, Moshe gives an accounting of all the monies that were taken in. Even Moshe has to be able to be totally transparent with what is happening with communal funds. The Beit Midrash is a place where people should be able to engage each other in open dialogue, where people shouldn't have to hide what they really think, or shouldn't have to hide where they come from. The more that we come to this ideal, the more that we are in a state of geula. And I will just end by saying, Mordechai and Esther remain in Persia, and so do the rest of the Jews. But we know that these events are happening from other sources, at the same time when there are Jews who are involved in coming back to Jerusalem, in setting in motion the rebuilding of a Jewish commonwealth and presence in the land of Israel. If I mention that in the Purim world, there are facades, there are masks. Perhaps one of the masks also is how much do people really have control over their destiny? And even when it seems that they are makers and shakers, that could dramatically change overnight. For Mordechai and Esther, whose agenda are they promoting when they're in the land of Persia? To what extent do they really have control over their destiny? To what extent can they really be Jewish? At what point is it that they may be promoting the whims of Ahasuerus, and even more so be at the mercy of Ahasuerus? The Jews coming back to the land of Israel at that time have the opportunity to create their sovereign state, to be able to decide what is the society which they want to create, and to be able to then take responsibility for that, for good and for bad. But it's theirs. So when we read the Megillah and tell the story, we really need to ask ourselves, what world are we part of? And how much is it that maybe We all too easily allow ourselves to become part of the Purim world. Purim Sameach to everyone.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.